Good morning and welcome to Sun Sounds of Tucson, Arizona. Today's date is the 27th of March, 2025. My name is Alan Jones, and I will be reading the news today from the Arizona Daily Star. Our headlines for today: His moral compass stood strong. Administration struggles with text leaks, and Supreme Court upholds Biden's ghost gun policy. Our first story: His moral compass stood strong. Attribution to Tony Davis of the Arizona Daily Star. He was a man from very humble beginnings, who never forgot where he came from or whom he was supposed to serve while in public service. He was a man who made sure that when he was in a room talking policy with decision makers, those who weren't in the room were never forgotten. He was the kind of man who, if you were talking with him for the first time, you would never know he was one of the most powerful members of Congress. And he was a champion of addressing the rights of indigenous communities, not least of which were Arizona's 22 tribes and Native Nations. These and other words of near reverence filled the air on Wednesday at a memorial service for longtime U.S. Representative Raul Grijalva at St. Augustine Cathedral in downtown Tucson. Grijalva died on March the 13th at age 77 of complications from treatment for lung cancer, his office has said. Governor Katie Hobbs, former U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California, former Interior Secretary Deborah Haaland, and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York took turns describing the late Democratic congressman as one of who fought unstintingly for social and environmental justice while attending to a devoted family. Among those watching from the nearly packed pews, which can hold about 1,250 people, were about 50 members of Congress, enough that it took two planes to get them here, Pelosi told the gathering. Ocasio-Cortez recounted Grijalva's upbringing as the son of a Brasio immigrant who lived on Canoa Ranch, south of Green Valley, where the future congressman and his parents stayed until he was five. He was a self-confessed mama's boy, Ocasio-Cortez said, then promptly segued into a story about a crucial interaction Grijalva had with his mother, Rafaela. While in middle school, that changed his outlook on life. When Raul was in the 7th or 8th grade or so, he was given a prestigious award. The school told him to invite his parents, but he let the ceremony go by without telling his mother. In those early adolescent years, he felt embarrassed because she couldn't quite speak English, and all the other parents could, an experience many bilingual children can relate to. After 3 months passed, his mother turned to Grijalva and asked, "How did the award go?" She knew, the congressman said. He told Raul, "Mira, Spanish for look or see, don't forget you were born with a nopal, a cactus leaf on your forehead, and that's you. That's who you are, and you should never be embarrassed by it." Ocasio-Cortez said the nopal or prickly pear symbolizes resilience, substance, and national identity in Mexican and Mesoamerican cultures. That moment changed Raul, Ocasio-Cortez said. He spoke of how it prompted him to be more conscious of how people treated one another and what issues he pursued. Pelosi quoted U.S. Representative Greg Stanton of Phoenix, description of Grijalva as a man with moral clarity of purpose and kindness. Whether you were staff or speaker, everyone was treated the same. He called me boss, I called him boss. When he was chair of the House Natural Resources Committee, Grijalva was a tireless voice for protecting the beauty of God's creation and for advancing environmental justice for all, Pelosi said. He did so as a prolific legislator, standing with tribes to win permanent protection for the Grand Canyon, and he led the passage of the Great American Outdoors Act, one of the most significant environmental conservation acts in a very long time, Pelosi said. the Act approved permanent funding for the Federal Land and Water Conservation Fund, which uses oil industry-based revenues to pay for major land acquisitions. I was particularly grateful when he brought the perspective of a congressional Hispanic and progressive causes into the debate over the Affordable Care Act that passed in 2010, Pelosi said. He was very central to all of that. Thanks to Raul, our future is brighter and more durable, and more represents our nation's beautiful diversity. Haaland, a U.S. representative from New Mexico, before becoming Interior Secretary in 2021, noted that she served as vice chair to Grijalva on the National Resources Committee and was also chair of a subcommittee on national forests and public lands. I'm honored to be with you all as we mourn the loss of a voice of conscience on the national stage, said Haaland. There was generally not a day that went by when I didn't see Mr. Grijalva in my office or his office or for people for the season. His doodled images he would draw reflected his quick wit. His moral compass stood strong, said Haaland. He was unwavering in his work to protect air, land, and water, and to protect tribal communities. He set a constructive tone for contentious hearings. He pointed out hypocrisy when he saw it. He led things in the right way and set up the ladder for others to climb, always in the name of those who can't stand up for themselves. Grijalva was driven by a basic belief in the goodness of people, Hobbs told the service. Throughout his time in public office, he never forgot why he was there. From his early days as a TUSD board member, in his time on the Pima County Board of Supervisors, and finally in the halls of Congress, Congressman Grijalva dedicated his life to uplifting others. As the dean of the Arizona delegation, he understood that his duty was not to politics, but to the people of Arizona. His courage and integrity were unwavering, Hobbs said. Perhaps the loudest applause from the crowd attending the service came when his daughter, Raquel, Adalita, and Marisa shared personal recollections of their father. Raquel recalled her father's mischievous streak, going back to his childhood when he used to drive his mother and sister crazy with his imitations of TV's Three Stooges. When the three daughters were young, their father once told them a scary story of a dismembered hairy hand, she said. Then he tucked us into bed and took the extra mile to go outside and scratch our bedroom window. We were only slightly traumatized in the process. When he had grandchildren, he took the opportunity to spoil them rotten, and on the south side that meant Maxi Pops, noisy instruments, and Google eyeglasses. Daughter Adelita noted her recent surprise upon reading in Wikipedia that her father was a hiker, for despite his decades of efforts to protect the public lands, a hiker he was not. Yard sales were more his thing, along with gift shops, flea markets, and craft fairs, she said. He was also a great cook, the kind who could throw together delicious meals from whatever was in the refrigerator. But the most brilliant thing Grijalva ever did was fall in love with his mama, Ramona, said Adelita, now chair of the Pima County Board of Supervisors. In her he found a caring, funny partner to build a family with a tireless dance partner and a steadfast support who never gave up on him. Our next story. Administration struggles with text leaks. Attribution to Amar Madhani, Stephen Groves, and David Klepper of the Associated Press. The Trump administration struggled Wednesday to stem the fallout from revelations that top national security officials discussed sensitive attack plans over a message app and mistakenly added a journalist to the chain. The White House claimed the information shared through the publicly available Signal app with Jeffrey Goldberg, editor-in-chief of the Atlantic magazine, was not classified, an assertion that Democrats said strains credulity considering that it detailed plans for an upcoming attack on Yemen's Houthis. The Houthis have been wreaking havoc on vital Red Sea shipping lanes since November 2023, as the Israeli-Hamas war raged. The decision on determining whether the information is classified ultimately lies with Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who, in the chain listed weapons systems and a timeline for the attack, "This is when the first bombs will definitely drop," he wrote. Senator Mark Warner, the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, said the position that the Trump administration is staking out can be described with one word: baloney. When you describe time, place, type of armaments used, do they think the American public is stupid? Warner said in an exchange with reporters. Senator Roger Wicker, the Republican chair of the Senate Armed Service Committee, said he and Senator Jack Reed, the committee's top Democrat, will send a letter to the Trump administration requesting an expedited Inspector General investigation into the use of Signal. They also called for a classified briefing with a top administration official who actually has the facts and can speak on behalf of the administration. The information, as published recently, appears to me to be such of a sensitive nature that, based on my knowledge, I would have wanted it classified, Wicker said. White House officials continue to insist no classified material was discussed in the March 13 to 15 Signal chain. President Donald Trump said he stands by his national security team and assailed the reporter's credibility. Hegseth, White House National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, and other administration officials on Wednesday uniformly insisted that no war plan was text on the signal, a claim that current and former U.S. official called semantics. War plans carry a specific meaning. They often refer to the numbered and highly classified planning documents, sometimes thousands of pages long, that would inform U.S. decisions in a case of a major conflict, such as if the United States is called to defend Taiwan. But the information Hegseth posted, specific attack details, selected human and weapon storage targets, was a subset of those plans and was likely informed by the same classified intelligence. Hegseth said on social media, "The message chain included no names, no targets, no locations, no units, no routes, no sources, no methods, and no classified information." He did not directly address Democrats' concern about the timing and weaponry detailed in the chain. Several Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee on Wednesday called for Hegseth to step down. "This is classified information. It's a weapons system, as well as a sequence of strikes, as well as details of the operation," said Representative Raja Krishnamoorthy, a Democrat from Illinois, who is on the committee. "He needs to resign immediately." Representative Jim Hines, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, in an exchange with the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, during the panel's hearing on global threats Wednesday, noted that her office's criteria on classified information make clear that it includes information providing indication or advance warnings that the U.S. or its allies are preparing an attack. Gabbard said the conversation included candid and sensitive information about military strikes against Houthi rebels in Yemen. But, as she told senators during testimony Tuesday, she said the text did not contain classified information. "It was a mistake that a reporter was inadvertently added," Gabbard said. The Trump administration's stance on the signal chain is also a notable departure from a U.S. government that routinely classifies a vast amount of far more mundane material, including millions of documents pertaining to military and intelligence operations and activities. The Atlantic released the entire signal chat Wednesday, showing that Hegseth provided the exact timing of the warplane launches and when the bombs would drop, before the men and women flying those attacks were airborne. The Pentagon and White House tried to deflect criticism by attacking Goldberg and The Atlantic. The magazine and Goldberg, however, repeatedly reached out to the White House before and after publication to gain additional context on the signal chat, and ensure that publishing the full text would not cause harm. In a response, Goldboard reported White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt described some of the information as sensitive and said the White House would prefer it not be published. In the group chat, Hegseth posted details about the impending strike using military language and laying out when a strike window starts, where a target terrorist was located, the time elements, and around the attack when various weapons and aircraft would be used in the strike. Details from the transcript included 12:15 Eastern Time, F-18's launch, first strike package, 13:45, trigger-based F-18 first strike, window starts, target terrorist is at his known location, so should be on time. Also, strike drones launched, MQ-9S. 14:10, more F-18s launch, second strike package. 14:15, strike drones on target. This is when the first bombs will definitely drop, pending earlier trigger-based targets. 15:36, F-18, second strike starts. Also, first sea-based Tomahawks launched. A strike package includes the personnel and weapons used in an attack, including Navy F-18 fighter aircraft, MQ-9S are armed drones, Tomahawks are ship-launched cruise missiles. The chat was also notable for who it excluded. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Christopher Grady, serves in that position in an acting capacity because Trump fired former Chairman General C.Q. Brown, Jr. in February. The Pentagon said it would not comment on the issue, and it was not immediately clear why Grady, currently serving as the president's top military advisor, would not be included in a discussion on military strikes. Our next story. Supreme Court upholds Biden's ghost gun policy. Attribution to Lindsay Whitehurst of the Associated Press. The Supreme Court on Wednesday upheld a Biden administration's regulation on the nearly impossible-to-trace weapons called ghost guns, clearing the way for continued serial numbers, background checks, and age verification requirements for buying the kits online. The 7-2 opinion found that existing gun laws allow regulation of the kits increasingly linked to crime. It comes after President Donald Trump ordered a review of federal gun policy that could undermine or reverse regulations championed by his predecessor. Sales of the homemade firearms grew exponentially as kits allowed for easy at-home building came into the market. Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote in the majority opinion, "Some home hobbyists enjoy assembling them, but criminals also find them attractive," he said. The number of ghost guns found at crime scenes around the country also soared, according to federal data. Fewer than 1,700 were recovered by law enforcement in 2017, but that number grew to 27,000 in 2023, according to Justice Department data. Since the federal rule was finalized, though ghost guns numbers flattened out or declined in several major cities, including New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, and Baltimore, according to court documents, manufacturing of miscellaneous gun parts also dropped 36% overall, the Justice Department reported. Ghost guns are any privately made firearm without the serial number that allows police to trace weapons used in a crime. The 2022 regulation was focused on kits sold online with everything needed to build a functioning firearm, sometimes in less than 30 minutes, according to court documents. Ghost guns have been used in high-profile crimes, including a mass shooting carried out with an AR-15-style ghost gun in Philadelphia that left 5 people dead. Police believe a ghost gun used in the slaying of United Healthcare's CEO in Manhattan was made on a 3D printer rather than assembled from a kit of the kind at the center of the Supreme Court case. finalized at the direction of then-President Joe Biden, the frame and receiver rule requires companies to treat the kits like other firearms by adding serial numbers, running backward checks, and verifying that buyers are 21 or older. Gun groups challenged the rule in court in the case known as Garland v. Vanderstock. Most crimes are committed with traditional firearms, not ghost guns, they argued. It's legal for people to build their own firearms at home, the challenger said, arguing that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms and Explosives overstepped their authority by trying to regulate the kits. The Supreme Court majority disagreed, pointing out that the law gives the ATF the power to regulate items that can be quickly made into working firearms. The buy-build-shoot kit can be readily converted into a firearm too, for it requires no more time, effort, or expertise or specialized tools to complete, Gorsuch wrote, referring to a specific product. Some kits may take more time to build into a gun and therefore fall outside of the ATF's power, he wrote, but many popular kits are subject to regulation. In response to the ruling, a Justice Department spokesperson said the administration would continue to support and defend the Second Amendment rights of all Americans. We will now move on to the Tucson and region news. Our first story. Lawmakers push to add revenge porn to Arizona law. Attribution to Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services. State lawmakers are moving to close a technologically created loophole in a law designated to protect against revenge pornography. But the measure approved by an 8-1 margin on Wednesday by the House Judiciary Committee has raised concerns that it could subject more people to possible felony charges. A 2016 Arizona law already makes it a felony to distribute nude or sexually explicit photos without consent. These often arise from situations when a relationship ends and the jilted partner decides to post explicit photos of the other person. Those images might have been made with that person's consent, but were not meant to be shared. And what made it more problematic, according to Senator J.D. Mesnard, who crafted the original state law, was the ability to not just create the images with smartphones, but to share them on the Internet. But on Wednesday, the Chandler Republican said yet another advancement has created a new problem, the exciting and frightening technology of artificial intelligence. Put simply, Mesnard said, that scientific leap now allows someone to generate very realistically nude pictures that are then shared for the purpose of hurting somebody. But, he said, since what's being shared online isn't an actual photo of somebody, that isn't forbidden under the existing law. His SB 1462 is designed to fix that. A very realistic-looking nude picture, but that's not technically of the person, but is used to harass and hurt the person. Generally, a woman could be captured in this statute, Mesnard told lawmakers in explaining the need for the change. Mesnard could not get the measure approved as originally crafted after it raised concerns from the Arizona chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. I think the bill violates the First Amendment without some sort of protection for persons who are engaged in a parody, artistic expression, political speech, said lobbyist Marilyn Rodriguez. Courts have concluded that these are protected, even if it is a vulgar image of a politician, she said. Those images may harm politicians or a famous person, but can also be protected speech, she said. And Rodriguez said she doubts that it's what Mesnard is trying to prevent. Mesnard agreed to alter the measure to create exceptions for an image made in the public interest, including scientific or education activities, a newsworthy or an issue of public concern. But Rodriguez made it clear that her organization still has concerns about the breadth of the measure, especially the possibility of someone being subject to a prison term of 2.5 years. The measure still is so broad, she said, that it could apply to someone who digitally alters an image of someone they see or know. It's far less intimate, Rodriguez said, than the original law that involves sending out photos that someone has shared in a relationship. I certainly wonder if it deserves a Class 4 felony designation, she said. It certainly seems like it, decriminalizing far more conduct than just the original revenge porn statute. And she said another worry is that young people could be charged for altering images for a laugh. We are really concerned that young people who are prone to mistakes and lack access to sexual education and education about the internet could be facing Class 4 felony for jokes, she said. The ACLU isn't the only one worried about the breadth of the bill. Catherine Kurgick, a volunteer attorney with Arizona Attorney for Criminal Justice, pointed out that the original revenge porn law required prosecutors to prove that the person in the image had a reasonable expectation of privacy. But Krajic, whose organization is composed of lawyers who defend people accused of crimes, told lawmakers that SB 1462 removes that requirement, and in a way that would allow charges to be brought against people who distribute images where the person in the photo had no such expectation. Mesnard, however, said that charge applies only to digitally created images. He said that since those depicted had no way of knowing someone was crafting the photo, there would be no way for them to have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Not everyone on the House Judiciary Committee was buying that explanation, or convinced that what Mesnard is proposing is just a minor change in the law. Representative Alexander Kolodin said he agrees with Krajic's interpretation that the legislation would make criminals out of those who share images where the person depicted has no expectation of privacy. Consider, said the Scottsdale Republican, a scenario where he might decide to tear naked through the floor of the House and the act was captured by a news reporter on camera. That would then be a crime, even though I had no reasonable expectation of privacy, because I was on the floor of the House, Kolodin asked as he cast the lone dissenting vote on the measure. The measure, which already has been approved in the Senate, now goes to the full House. Our next story. Third Provost finalist holds forum today. Attribution to Prerana Sanapanavar of the Arizona Daily Star. The third finalist in the University of Arizona's provost search is a political scientist and administrator at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. William T. Bernard, who has been at the UICU for 28 years in numerous academic and leadership positions, is currently Executive Vice Provost for Academic Affairs and Interim Associate Chancellor and Vice Provost for Budget and Resource Planning. Bernard is set to visit the U of A for in-person interviews on Thursday, March 27th, and will have an open forum session at 9 a.m. at the U of A's Menil Optical Science Building, in which faculty and staff will be able to ask him questions. The first two candidates in the provost search, Eric Barker and Jenna Rickers, both come from Purdue University and were on campus last week for their forums and in-person meetings. Rickers is Senior Vice Provost for Teaching and Learning, and Baker is Vice President for Health Affairs and Dean of the Pharmacy College. Suresh Garamella, who was officially installed as U of A's president on Tuesday, was a Purdue administrator before becoming president of the University of Vermont and then U of A president. The U of A search for a senior vice president for an academic affairs and provost, a position now held by Ron Marks, in the interim began after Garamella took the reins on October the 1st. Bernard's roles at the University of Illinois over the years included assistant, associate, and professor roles, director of graduate students, and head of the political science department, interim executive associate dean in the College of Media, associate provost for faculty and development, vice provost for academic affairs, and interim vice chancellor for academic affairs and provost. His current responsibilities include providing leadership in the areas of academic and faculty affairs, faculty development, the Provost Fellows Program, human resources, academic awards and assessments, according to the UIC website. He's also tasked with providing strategic budget planning and allocation advice to the Chancellor and Provost, guidance to the university in areas related to budget, finance, planning and resource allocation, and leadership and management of the campus budget office. Bernard has had a master's degree and a PhD in political science and a bachelor's degree in government, did his undergraduate education at Cornell in New York, and his graduate and postgraduate education at Duke. His book, Legislative Style, published in 2018, investigates how members of Congress allocate their time and effort across different activities. His research also examines the strategic choice of politicians, including how parties manage candidate nominations and how the potential for immigration across borders shapes foreign policy choices, according to UICU's website. The book was awarded the 2015 Patrick J. Fett Award and the 2014 Jewel Loewenberg Award. Bernhard was described as a political scientist with a funny bone in a September 2022 article by the News Gazette, a newspaper in central Illinois. The article also says he's frugal, still living in his first purchased house, driving a car with 110,000 miles on it, and wearing sports coats that he bought in college. In the article, Bernhard said, "The hardest thing about being a leader is being present. There are many demands, and it is easy to be distracted. Giving full attention to the topic at hand can be difficult, especially," he joked, "if I had had too much caffeine." Among recognitions awarded to Bernard over the years are Graduate Mentor of the Year in the Political Science Department, Alumni Discretionary Award in the College of Liberal Arts and Science, Campus Research Award, and being listed among researchers rated as excellent by their students. Our next story. Tucson Trust buys Amado Farm. Attribution to Henry Breen of the Arizona Daily Star. More than 4 miles of an ephemeral creek that feeds into the Santa Cruz River south of Green Valley is now in the hands of conservationists. The Arizona Land and Water Trust has completed its purchase of the Sapori Farm, a historic spread in Amado, once targeted for development as part of a 6,800-home master-planned community. The Tucson-based nonprofit closed on the final 886-acre farm along Sapori Creek last month for an undisclosed amount. Cameron Becker, conservationist director for the trust, said they plan to place a protective easement on the property to permanently preserve it as farmland and wildlife habitat, as they search for a conservation-minded buyer interested in maintaining it as a working, ecologically friendly agricultural operation. He said the farm has a lot to offer, with 327 acres of irrigated farmland adjacent to the frontage road on the west side of Interstate 19 and sitting atop one of the few shallow groundwater aquifers left within a 40 miles of Tucson. Assuming the property is eventually sold, the trust will remain involved in its protection by retaining ownership of the conservation easement placed on the land. "We are excited to continue our collaborative work to protect this vital landscape for future generations," Michael McDonald, the trust executive director, said in a written statement. The group is still looking for someone to buy its other major acquisitions in the same area, a 2,550-acre portion of the nearby Sapporo Ranch it purchased in 2018 from the developer behind the proposed master-planned community. That residential project was abandoned after Santa Cruz County voters overwhelmingly rejected it in 2008. A month later, Pima County swooped in and paid the developer $18.6 million for 4,135 acres of the old ranch and 10,000 acres of the surrounding state agricultural leases to add to the county's open space program. According to the trust, Sapori Creek is part of one of the oldest continuously occupied areas in the United States, with evidence of humans dating back almost 12,000 years. Spanish explorer Juan Bautista de Anza grazed livestock on the land during his time at the Tubac Presidio, south of Tucson, in the latter half of the 18th century. Hollywood movie mogul Jack Warner and his family owned the ranch from 1950 to 1993. The trust purchased the first 371 acres of Sapori Farm in the May of 2021. Since 1978, the group has helped preserve more than 67,000 acres of what is called vanishing Western landscapes through purchases, donations, and the designation of conservation easements across Arizona. Becker said they are currently working to protect another 10,000 acres near the Chiricahua Mountains and in the Sonoyta area. The trust's acquisitions in the Sapori area include habitat for listed species such as the endangered Pima pineapple cactus and the threatened yellow-billed cuckoo, and part of a vital riparian wildlife corridor connecting the surrounding Sky Island mountain range to Sapori Creek and the Santa Cruz River. Becker said native animals such as deer, javelina, coati, skunks, and badgers have been photographed on the properties by a series of trail cameras operated by the trust in partnership with the Coalition for Sonoran Desert Protection. The land is not currently open to the public, but the conservation easement would not prevent a future owner from allowing access someday for now low-impacted activities such as hiking or birdwatching, Becker said. The trust Sapori properties fall within the proposed boundaries of the Santa Cruz River, urban national wildlife refuge, a federal designation now being sought by the local governments and conservationists for a 90-mile swath of the river valley from Mexico to Marana. The prospects for a new refuge remains uncertain during the second Trump administration, especially with the president threatening to rescind or reduce the size of national monuments approved by his predecessors in the White House. Becker said the trust hasn't had any discussion with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services about incorporating its holdings into the proposed refuge. However, the protection of Sapori builds upon all of the collaborative conservation efforts that have been accomplished within the area of focus, he said. The trust most recently put its Sapori Ranch property up for sale about a year ago and got a couple of strong bites, Becker said, but they ultimately withdrew the listings after failing to find a good fit for the land's overreaching conservation mission. He said, "The trust can afford to be patient. We're not in the business of owning and managing land. But as a non-profit, if we need to hold on to it for a while, that's okay," Becker said. "Ideally, we'd love for the right person to walk in the door tomorrow. But to us, having the right person is more important." Our next story. Senators Gallego, Kelly both call on Hegseth to resign. Attribution to Ronald J. Hansen of the Arizona Republic. Both of Arizona's U.S. senators have now called on Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to resign after he provided details of a looming military strike on Yemen in an unsecured group chat on Signal. Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat from Arizona, who doubted Hegseth fit to head the Pentagon when he opposed that nomination in January, added his name to the list of Democrats now calling for Hegseth to step down. The Signal incident is what happens when you have the most unqualified Secretary of Defense we've ever seen, Kelly said in a statement on March the 26th. We're lucky it didn't cost any service members their lives. But for the safety of our military and our country, Secretary Hegseth needs to resign. His seatmate, Senator Ruben Gallego, Democrat of Arizona, did the same on March the 24th, the day news about the chat thread was published. This is ridiculous and dangerous. Hegseth needs to resign. He compromised the security of our men and women. Most importantly, he could have compromised the mission's objective, Gallegos said. Kelly's assessment comes as Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee grilled Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence, in a hearing mirroring a March 25th hearing in the Senate. The controversy over the group chat started when Jeffrey Goldberg, editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, wrote a story that disclosed he was mistakenly included in the group chat, which outlined the plans for the March 15 attack on Iranian-aligned rebels in Sana'a, Yemen. On March the 26th, the magazine published more of the messages that were posted in the group chat. The White House and the National Security Council have acknowledged the Atlantic messages were genuine, but Hegseth has lashed out at Goldberg personally and maintained to reporters that nobody was texting war plans. To this point, Republicans have offered only muted criticism of the Pentagon for the evident security lapse, suggesting that it was a mistake that should not cost Hegseth his job. The controversy is a reversal from Republicans who pressed former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton over sending classified information over unsecured emails during the Obama administration. During the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing, Kelly pressed CIA Director John Ratcliffe about whether discussing forthcoming military operations in an unsecured environment such as Signal was appropriate. Pre-decision strikes, deliberations should be conducted through classified channels, Ratcliffe said. The chat included information about weapons packages, targets and timing, and Vice President J.D. Vance and the Secretary of State Marco Rubio were among those included in it. Kelly, a Navy combat pilot and member of the Senate Armed Service Committee, was wary about Hegseth leading the Pentagon from the time then-President-elect Donald Trump said he would nominate the former Fox News commentator for the post in his second administration. Kelly said Hegseth could not survive scrutiny of his record if placed under oath because of a past that includes public drunkenness, allegations of sexual assault, and poor management decisions. Kelly and Gallego both voted against Hegseth's confirmation. Pete Hegseth doesn't bring the kind of experience that prepares someone to do this massive job, and he was unable to answer direct questions at his hearing about concerned personal issues, Kelly said at the time. Gallego was similarly skeptical that Hegseth could effectively head the Pentagon. The stakes could not be higher for the men and women who serve our country and put their lives on the line to secure our freedoms, he said. Our service members need an experienced leader, especially at a time when America is facing evolving threats, from conflict in the Middle East to an increasingly aggressive China. Pete Hegseth is not that leader. We will now move on to the nation and world news. Our first story. Trump enacts auto tariff. Attribution to Josh Boke of the Associated Press. President Donald Trump said Wednesday he will place a 25% tariff on auto imports, a move the White House claims would foster domestic manufacturing but could also put a financial squeeze on automakers that depend on global supply chains. This will continue to spur growth, Trump told news reporters. We'll effectively be charging a 25% tariff. The tariffs, which the White House expects to raise $100 billion in revenue annually, could be complicated as even U.S. automakers source their components from around the world. The tax hike, starting in April, means automakers could face higher costs and lower sales. Trump has long said that tariffs against the auto imports would be a defining policy of his presidency, betting that the costs created by the taxes would cause more production to relocate to the United States while helping to narrow the budget deficit. But U.S. and foreign automakers have plants around the world to accommodate global sales while also maintaining competitive prices, and it could take years for companies to design, build, and open new factories that Trump promises. We're looking at much higher vehicle prices, said economist Mary Lovely, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. We're going to see reduced choice. These kinds of taxes fall more heavily on the middle and working class. She said more households will be priced out of the new car market, where prices already average around $49,000, and will have to hang on to aging vehicles. The tariffs on autos will start being collected on April the 3rd, Trump said. If the taxes are fully passed on to consumers, the average auto price could jump by about $12,500, a sum that could feed into overall inflation. After losing the 2020 election, Trump returned to the White House in large part because voters believed he could bring down prices. The auto tariffs are part of a broader reshaping of global relations by Trump, who plans to impose what he calls reciprocal taxes on April the 2nd that would match the tariffs, sales taxes charged by other nations. Trump already placed a 20% import tax on all imports from China. He similarly placed 25% tariffs on Mexico and Canada, with a lower 10% tax on Canadian energy products. Parts of the Mexican and Canadian tariffs were suspended, including the taxes on autos, after automakers objected, and Trump gave them a 30-day reprieve that is scheduled to expire in April. Our next story. Palestinians protest war, Hamas. Attribution to Sami Magdi, Fatma Khaled, and Sara El Deeb of the Associated Press. Thousands of Palestinians marched among the wreckage of a mostly destroyed town in northern Gaza on Wednesday, on the second day of anti-war protests, with many chanting against Hamas in a rare display of public anger toward the militant group. The protests, which centered mainly in Gaza north, appeared to be aimed generally against the war, with protesters calling for an end to the 17 months of deadly fighting with Israel that has made life in Gaza insufferable. But protesters also leveled unusually direct and public criticism of Hamas, which squashed dissent violently in the past in Gaza, a territory it still rules months into the war with Israel. In the town of Beit Lahia, where a similar protest took place Tuesday, about 3,000 people demonstrated, with many chanting, "The people want the fall of Hamas." In the hard-hit Sharia neighborhood of Gaza City, dozens of men chanted, "Out, out, out, Hamas, get out. Our children have been killed. Our houses have been destroyed," said Abed Radwan, who said he joined the protest in Beit Lahia against the war against Hamas and the Palestinians' political faction against Israel and against the world's silence. The militant group violently cracked down on previous protests. This time, no outright intervention was apparent, perhaps because Hamas is keeping a lower profile since Israel resumed its war against it. Senior Hamas official Bassem Naim, in a post on Facebook, wrote that people had the right to protest, but that their focus should be on the criminal aggressor, Israel. The protests erupted a week after Israel ended its ceasefire with Hamas by launching a surprise wave of strikes that killed hundreds of people. This month, Israel halted deliveries of food, fuel, medicine, and aid to Gaza, roughly 2 million Palestinians. Israel vowed to escalate the war until Hamas returns the 59 hostages it still holds, 24 of them believed to be alive. Hamas won a landslide victory in the most recent Palestinian elections held in 2006. It seized power in Gaza from the West-backed Palestinian Authority, dominated by the secular Fatah movement, the following year after months of factional unrest. Our next story. Sudan's army moves closer to retaking Khartoum, attribution to the Associated Press. Sudan's army said Wednesday it recaptured Khartoum's international airport, and the military chief flew back to the capital for the first time in nearly 2 years of war, bringing the military closer to regaining full control of the city from the rival Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group. Footage put out by the military showed Army Chief General Abdel Fattah Burhan landing at Khartoum International Airport, kissing the ground and raising his fist in the air to troops as he emerged from a helicopter onto the tarmac. Khartoum is now free. It's over. Khartoum is free, Burhan is heard telling cheering troops, according to video footage aired by Al Jazeera television. He later went to the presidential palace, the pre-war seat of the government, which troops wrested from RSF control on Friday. The RSF is still believed to hold scattered positions in Khartoum, and the government has not yet declared full victory in the city. But Burhan's return capped a series of gains by his forces in the capital and marked a major symbolic landmark in the war. Burhan and his military-led government had to flee Khartoum, moving to the Red Sea coastal city of Port Sudan soon after the war began in April of 2023. The war broke out when the military and the RSF turned against each other in a struggle for power. Their battle around Khartoum left the RSF in control of the airport, presidential palace, and other neighborhoods as the fighting spread across the country. Seizing the capital doesn't end the conflict, as the RSF still controlled parts of the western Darfur region and other areas. Earlier in the day, the military announced it recaptured the RSF's last major stronghold in Khartoum, the Tiba al-Hasnab camp. There was no immediate RSF comment. Our next story. Ports Green Initiatives in question. Attribution to Alexa St. John and Etienne Lorrain of the Associated Press. On a grey March afternoon at the Port of Los Angeles, the largest in the U.S. powerful electric top handlers whirr, beep, and grind as they motor back and forth, grabbing trailers from trucks' beds and stacking them as they move on and off the mighty container ships that ferry goods across the Pacific. Some of the ships, rather than burning diesel to sustain operations as they sit in harbor, plug into the electricity instead. The shift to electricity is part of the efforts to clean up the air around America's ports, which long struggled with pollution that chokes nearby neighborhoods and jeopardizes the health of people living there. The landmark climate law championed by former Democratic President Joe Biden earmarked $3 billion to boost those efforts. Some of the people who live near the U.S. hubs now worry that President Donald Trump's administration could cancel or claw back some of that money. Our area is disproportionately affected by pollution directly related to the port's activities, said Therrell Golden, who's lived in the West Long Beach area for more than 50 years. He pointed to the trucks moving back and forth on the nearby highways and overpasses. It's all part of the same goods movement's effort, and it has to be cleaned up. The Biden money aimed to slash 3 million metric tons of carbon pollution across 55 ports in more than two dozen states through cleaner equipment and vehicles, plus infrastructure and community engagement. Some ports say they already spent hundreds of millions to replace older, dirtier equipment. Members of the American Association of Port Authorities, representing more than 130 public port authorities in the U.S. and beyond, plan at least $50 billion more of decarbonization projects. Many are easy, for example, drayage trucks, which drive short distances between ports and nearby warehouses, are good candidates for electrification, since they don't have to go far between charges. The Biden money wasn't enough to completely solve the problem. Project requests alone topped $8 billion per the Environmental Protection Agency. But it was a substantial investment that many experts said was the biggest outlay of federal funding they'd seen toward the problem. Trump sought to roll back his predecessor's clean energy, air, water, and environmental justice policies. He also froze federal funding, disrupting community organizations and groups planning on the funds for everything from new solar projects to electric school buses and other programs. EPA spokesperson Shayla Powell said the agency worked to enable payment accounts for infrastructure, law, Inflation and Reduction Act grant recipients, so funding is now accessible. While one port said the program was set to be active, Others were waiting for the federal grant funding review process to be completed or were monitoring the situation. The nation's 300 public and private shipping ports have been centers of pollution for decades. The goods Americans want, from cars to building materials to orange juice, are moved by mostly diesel-fueled cranes, trucks and locomotives that emit planet-warming carbon dioxide and cancerous toxins that contribute to heart diseases, asthma and shorter lifespans. In addition to thousands of longshoremen, truckers and other workers, port operations affect about 31 million Americans living nearby, according to the EPA, often in largely black, Latino and low-income communities. Some ports manage to get a little cleaner through private investment, state regulation, diesel pollution reduction efforts, and international maritime requirements to cut emissions. In voluntary emissions reporting, hubs including the ports of Los Angeles, Long Beach, and New York and New Jersey say some aspects of their operations significantly improved over the past two decades. By many of the port's own accounts, they still release tons of sulfur dioxides, particulate matters, nitrogen oxides, and more. However, certain emissions increased. Independence groups confirmed this. The South Coast Air Quality Management District, a regulatory agency for parts of the Los Angeles region, said that while San Pedro emissions dropped with more reduction efforts, that pace slowed. The ports still contribute significantly to local emissions. Communities nearby are still going to be vulnerable, said Houston resident Hernade Travito, co-founder of outreach group the Racias Collab Project. Advocates and frontline groups like hers think Trump's attack on pollution regulations will harm further efforts. Travino takes several medication and uses an inhaler to manage fatigue, stomach aches, headaches, and body pain that she blames on pollution from the port of Houston. The port said pollutants dropped from 2013 to 2019, but some emissions from more vessel activity increased. Houston was flagged by the American Lung Association as one of America's dirtiest cities based on ozone and year-round particle pollution. ALA didn't detail the source of the pollution. Ed Aval, a University of Southern Arizona professor emeritus in clinical medicine, said the motivation to clean up air pollution to protect human and environmental health is clear. But the whipsaw back and forth of the current administration's decision-making process makes it hard to move forward, he said. Despite being major contributors to U.S. economic activity, ports say they are financially stretched by pressure to automate operations bound by contentious labor issues. Moving to electric equipment or vehicles might not be the best option, said Ports Associate Government Relations Director Ian Gansler. Electric equipment is more expensive than diesel-fueled. Ports might need more of it due to charging time requirements, and it might take up more room in port. Meanwhile, upgrading electrical services at a port could cost more than $20 million per berth, and some ports have dozens of berths. Ports, too, have to work with utilities to make sure they have enough power. This brings us to the end of today's broadcast of the Arizona Daily Star. Thank you for listening. This is Alan Jones signing off.